Today I'm reading The Promise by C. Wright Mills. Nowadays, men often feel that their private lives are a series of traps. They sense that within their everyday worlds, they cannot overcome their troubles. And in this feeling, they are often quite correct. What ordinary men are directly aware of and what they try to do are bounded by the private orbits in which they live. Their visions and their powers are limited to the close-up scene, job, family, neighborhood. In other milieu, they move vicariously and remain spectators. And the more aware they become, however vaguely, of ambitions, threats, transcend their immediate locales, the more trapped they become. Underlying this sense of being trapped are seemingly impersonal changes in the very structure of continent-wide society. The facts of contemporary history are also facts about the success and the failure of individual men and women. When a society is industrialized, a peasant becomes a worker, a feudal lord is liquidated or becomes a business. When classes rise or fall, a man is employed or unemployed. When the rate of investment goes up or down, a man takes new heart or goes broke. When wars happen, an insurance salesman becomes a rocket launcher, a store clerk, a radar. A wife lives alone, a child grows up without a father. Neither the life of an individual nor the history of a society can be understood without understanding both. Yet men do not usually define the troubles they endure in terms of historical change and institutional contradiction. The well-being they enjoy, they do not usually impute to the big ups and downs of the societies in which they live, seldom aware of the intricate connection between the patterns of their own lives and the course of world history. Ordinary men do not usually know what this connection means for the kinds of men they are becoming and for the kinds of history making in which they might take part. They do not possess the quality of mind essential to grasp the interplay of man and society, of biography and history, of self and world. They cannot cope with their personal troubles in such ways as to control the structural transformations that usually lie behind them. Surely it is no wonder. In what period have so many men been so totally exposed at so fast a pace to such earthquakes of change? That Americans have not known such catastrophic changes as have the men in societies is due to historical facts that are now quickly becoming, quote, nearly history. The history that now affects every man is world history. Within this scene and this period, in the course of a single generation, 1/6 of mankind is transformed from all that is feudal and backward into all that is modern, advanced, fearful. Political colonies are freed, new and less visible forms of imperialism installed, revolutions occur, men feel the intimate grip of new kinds of authority, totalitarian societies rise and are smashed to bit or succeed fabulously. After 2 centuries of ascendance, capitalism is shown up as only one way to make society into an industrial apparatus. After 2 centuries of hope, even formal democracy is restricted to a quite small portion of mankind. Everywhere in the underdeveloped world, ancient ways of life are broken up and vague expectations become urgent demand. Everywhere in the overdeveloped world, the means of authority and of violence become total in scope and bureaucratic in form. Humanity itself now lies before us, the supernation at either pole concentrating its most coordinated and massive efforts upon the preparation of World War III. Keep in mind, by the way, this was written in 1959. The very shaping of history now outpaces the ability of men to orient themselves in accordance with cherished values. And which values? Even when they do not panic, men often sense that older ways of feeling and thinking have collapsed, and that newer beginnings are ambiguous to the point of moral stasis. Is it any wonder that ordinary men feel they cannot cope with the larger worlds with which they are so suddenly confronted, that they cannot understand the meaning of their epoch for their own lives, that in defense of selfhood, they become morally insensible, trying to remain altogether private? Is it any wonder that they come to be possessed by a sense of the trap? It is not only information that they need. In this age of fact, information often dominates their attention, overwhelms their capacity to assimilate. It is not only the skills of reason that they need, although their struggles to acquire these often exhaust their limited moral. What they need, and what they feel they need, is a quality of mind that will help them to use information and to develop reason in order to achieve lucid summations of what is going on in the world and of what may be happening within themselves. It is this quality, I'm going to contend, that journalists and scholars, artists and public, scientists and editors are coming to expect of what we make, what may be called the sociological imagination. The sociological imagination enables its possessor to understand the larger historical scene in terms of its meaning for the inner life and the external career of a variety of individuals. It enables him to take into account how individuals, in the welter of their daily experience, often become falsely conscious of their social position. Within that welter, the framework of modern society is sought, and within that framework, the psychologies of a variety of men and women are formulated. By such means, the personal uneasiness of individuals is focused upon explicit trouble, and the indifference of publics is transformed into involvement with public issues. The first fruit of this imagination, and the first lesson of the social science that embodies it, is the idea that the individual can understand his own experience and gauge his own fate only by locating himself within his period, and that he can know his own chances in life only by becoming aware of those of all individuals in his circumstances. In many ways, it is a terrible lesson. In many ways, a magnificent. We do not know the limits of man's capacities for supreme effort or willing degradation, for agony and glee, for pleasurable brutality, or the sweetness of reason. But in our time, we have come to know that the limits of, quote, human nature are frighteningly broad. We have come to know that every individual lives from one generation to the next in some society, that he lives out a biography, and that he lives it out within some historical society. By the fact of his living, he contributes, however minutely, to the shaping of this society and to the course of its history, even as he is made by society and by its historical push up. The sociological imagination enables us to grasp history and biography and the relations between the two within society. That is its task and its promise. To recognize this task and this promise is the mark of the classic social analyst. It is characteristic of Herbert Spencer, turgid, polysyllabic, comprehensive, of E.A. Ross, graceful, Muckrake, upright, of Auguste Comte and Emile Durkheim, of the intricate and subtle Karl Mannheim. It is the quality of all that is intellectually excellent in Karl Marx. It is the clue to Thorstein Veblen's brilliant and ironic insight, to Joseph Schumpeter's many-sided constructions of reality. It is the basis of the psychological sweep of W.E.H. Lecky, no less than of the profundity and clarity of Max Weber, and it is the signal of what is best in contemporary studies of man and society. No social study that does not come back to the problems of biography, of history, and of their interconnections within a society has completed its intellectual journey. Whatever the specific problems of the classical social analysts, however limited or however broad the features of social reality they have examined, those who have been imaginatively aware of the promise of their work have consistently asked three sorts of questions. 1. What is the structure of this particular society as a whole? What are its essential components, and how are they related to one another? How does it differ from other varieties of social order? Within it, what is the meaning of any particular feature for its continuance and for its change? 2. Where does this society stand in human history? What are the mechanics by which it is changing? What is its place within and its meaning for the development of humanity as a whole? How does any particular feature we are examining affect, and how is it affected by, the historical period in which it moved? And this period, what are its essential features? How does it differ from other periods? What are its characteristic ways of history? 3. What varieties of men and women now prevail in this society and in this period? And what varieties are coming to prevail? In what ways are they selected and formed, liberated and repressed, made sensitive and blunted? What kinds of, quote, human nature are revealed in the conduct and character we observe in this society in this period? And what is the meaning for, quote, human nature of each and every feature of the society we are examining? End of list. Whether the point of interest is a great power state or a minor literary mood, a family, a prison, a creed, these are the kinds of questions the best social analysts have asked. They are the intellectual pivots of classical studies of man and society, and they are the questions inevitably raised by any mind possessing the sociological imagination. For that imagination is the capacity to shift from one perspective to another, from the political to the psychological, from examination of a single family to comparative assessment of the national budgets of the world, from the theological school to the military establishment, from considerations of an oil industry to studies of contemporary poetry. It is the capacity to range from the most impersonal and remote transformation to the most intimate features of the human self, and to see the relations between the two. That, in brief, is why it is by means of the sociological imagination that men now hope to grasp what is going on in the world, and to understand what is happening in themselves as minute point at the intersections of biography and history within society. In large part, contemporary man's self-conscious view of himself as at least an outsider, if not a permanent stranger, rests upon an absorbed realization of social relativity and of the transformative power of history. The sociological imagination is the most fruitful form of this self-consciousness. By its use, men whose mentalities have swept only a series of limited orbits can often come to feel as if suddenly awakened in a house with which they had only supposed themselves to be familiar. Correctly or incorrectly, they often come to feel that they can now provide themselves with adequate summation, cohesive assessment, comprehensive orientation. Older decisions that once appeared sound now seem to them products of a mind unaccountably dense. Their capacity for astonishment is made lively again. They acquire a new way of thinking. They experience a transvaluation of values. In a word, by their reflection and by their sensibility, they realize the cultural meaning of the social science. Perhaps the most fruitful distinction with which the sociological imagination works is between the personal troubles of the milieu and the public issues of social structure. This distinction is an essential tool of the sociological imagination and a feature of all classic work in social science. Troubles occur within the character of the individual and within the range of his immediate relations with others. They have to do with his self and with those limited areas of social life of which he is directly and personally aware. Accordingly, the statement and the resolution of troubles properly lie within the individual as a biographical entity and within the scope of his immediate milieu, the social setting that is directly open to his personal experience and to some extent his willful activity. A trouble is a private matter. Values cherished by an individual are felt by him to be threatened. Issues have to do with matters that transcend these local environments of the individual. and the range of his inner life. They have to do with the organization of many such milieu into the institutions of a historical society as a whole, with the ways in which various milieu overlap and interpenetrate to form the larger structure of social and historical life. An issue is a public matter. Some value cherished by publics is felt to be threatened. Often there is a debate about what that value really is and about what it is that really threatens it. This debate is often without focus, if only because it is the very nature of an issue, unlike even widespread trouble, that it cannot very well be defined in terms of the immediate and everyday environments of ordinary men. An issue, in fact, often involves a crisis in institutional arrangement, and often, too, it involves what Marxists call contradictions, or antagonism. In these terms, consider unemployment. When, in a city of 100,000, only one man is unemployed, that is his personal trouble. And for its relief, we properly look to the character of the man, his skills, and his immediate opportunity. But when in a nation of 50 million employees, 15 million men are unemployed, that is an issue, and we may not hope to find its solution within the range of opportunities open to any one individual. The very structure of opportunities has collapsed. But the correct statement of the problem and the range of possible solutions requires us to consider the economic and political institutions of the society, and not merely the personal situation and character of a scatter of individuals. Consider war. The personal problem of war, when it occurs, may be how to survive it and how to die in it, or how to die in it with honor, how to make money out of it, how to climb into higher safety of the military apparatus, or how to contribute to the war's termination. In short, according to one's values, to find a set of milieu and within it to survive the war or make one's death in it meaningful. But the structural issues of war have to do with its causes, with what types of men it throws up into command, with its effect upon economic and political, family and religious institutions, with the unorganized irresponsibility of a world of nation-states. Consider marriage. Inside a marriage, a man and a woman may experience personal trouble, but when the divorce rate during the first 4 years of marriage is 250 out of every 1,000 attempts, this is an indication of a structural issue having to do with the institutions of marriage and the family and other institutions that bear onto them. Or consider the metropolis. The horrible, beautiful, ugly, magnificent sprawl of the great city. For many upper-class people, the personal solution to, quote, the problem of the city, is to have an apartment with a private garage under it in the heart of the city, and 40 miles out, a house by Henry Hill, garden by Garrett Ekbo, or 100 acres of private land. In these two controlled environments, with a small staff at each end, private helicopter connection, most people could solve many of the problems of personal milieu caused by the fact of the city. But all this, however splendid, does not solve the public issue that the structural fact of the city poses. What should be done with this wonderful monstrosity? Break it all up into scattered units, combining residence and work? Refurbish it as it stands? Or, after excavation, dynamite it and build new cities according to new plans in new places? What should those plans be? And who is to decide and to accomplish whatever choice is made? These are structural issues. To confront them and to solve them requires us to consider political and economic issues that affect innumerable milieu. Insofar as an economy is so arranged that slumps occur, the problem of unemployment becomes inescapable of personal solution. Insofar as war is inherent in the nation-state system and in the uneven industrialization of the world, the ordinary individual in his restricted milieu will be powerless, with or without psychiatric aid, to solve the troubles the system, or lack of system, imposes upon him. Insofar as the family as an institution turns women into darling little slaves and men into their chief providers and unweaned dependents, the problem of a satisfactory marriage remains incapable of purely private solution. Insofar as the overdeveloped megalopolis and the overdeveloped automobile are built-in features of the overdeveloped society, the issues of urban life will not be solved by personal ingenuity and private wealth. What we experience in various and specific milieu I have noted is often caused by structural changes. Accordingly, to understand the changes of many personal milieu, we are required to look beyond them, and the number and variety of such structural changes increase as the institutions within which we live become more embracing and more intricately connected with one another. To be aware of the idea of social structure and to use it with sensibility is to be capable of tracing such linkages among a great variety of milieu. To be able to do that is to possess the sociological imagination. End of the prompt.